You're listening to a program produced in 2016 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. The sentences in this novel, I'm sure those of you who have read it will agree, are so beautiful, you actually have to put the book down and just savor the wonder. Who else could describe his grandparents' New York apartment as a, quote, Martian zoo of Danish furniture? Or his mother's recollection as, quote, an empty quadrant of space lit by infrequent stars? I love that. Michael Chabon is the best-selling and Pulitzer Prize-winning author of many, many books, among them The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, Wonder Boys, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, The Yiddish Policeman's Union, Telegraph Avenue, and the picture book The Astonishing Secret of Awesome Man. He's chairman of the board of directors of the McDowell Colony, and in March 2002, he was voted into the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and he lives with his family in beautiful Berkeley, California. Tonight, Michael is in conversation with David L. Ulan, our L.A. friend of Aloud, for many years the book editor and then book critic of the Los Angeles Times. David is the author or editor of 9 books, most recently Sidewalking, Coming to Terms with Los Angeles, and his anthology Writing Los Angeles, a literary anthology, won the California Book Award. We are so thrilled to be welcoming these two wonderful writers to our stage tonight. We'll start this evening with a reading by Michael Chabon. Please join me in welcoming Michael and David Ulan to the stage of the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Good evening. Hi. How are you? I'm in a very good spirits for the moment anyway, because I had a really good taco over at the Grand Central Market for coming here. So you're just going to get the benefit of that, the carnitas. I'm just going to read very briefly just the first section of the book. I'm going to move this way because I'm going to keep leaning into it, but it's actually not life. And I'll just be tempted. This is how I heard the story. When Alger Hiss got out of prison, he had a hard time finding a job. He was a graduate of Harvard Law School, had clerked for Oliver Wendell Holmes, and helped charter the United Nations. Yet he was also a convicted perjurer and notorious as a tool of international communism. He had published a memoir, but it was dull stuff, and no one wanted to read it. His wife had left him. He was broke and hopeless. In the end, one of his remaining friends took pity on the bastard and pulled a string. Hiss was hired by a New York firm that manufactured and sold a kind of fancy barrette made from loops of piano wire. Feathercombs Incorporated had gotten off to a good start, but had come under attack from a bigger competitor that copied its designs, infringed on its trademarks, and undercut its pricing. Sales had dwindled. Payroll was tight. In order to make room for Hiss, somebody had to be let go. In an account of my grandfather's arrest in the Daily News for May 25th, 1957, he is described by an unnamed co-worker as the quiet type. To his fellow salesman at Feathercombs, he was a Homburg on the coat rack in the corner. He was the hardest working but least effective member of the Feathercombs sales force. On his lunch breaks, he holed up with a sandwich and the latest issue of Sky and Telescope or Aviation Week. It was known that he drove a Crosley, had a foreign-born wife and a teenage daughter, and lived with them somewhere in deepest Bergen County. Before the day of his arrest, my grandfather had distinguished himself to his co-workers only twice. During Game 5 of the 1956 World Series, when the office radio failed, my grandfather had repaired it with a vacuum tube prized from the interior of the telephone switchboard. And a Feathercombs copywriter reported once bumping into my grandfather at the paper mill playhouse in Millburn, where the foreign wife was, of all things, starring as Serafina in The Rose Tattoo. Beyond this, nobody knew much about my grandfather, and that seemed to be the way he preferred it. People had long since given up trying to engage him in conversation. He had been known to smile, but not to laugh. If he held political opinions, if he held opinions of any kind, they remained a mystery around the offices of Feathercombs Incorporated. It was felt he could be fired without damage to morale. Shortly after 9 o'clock, on the morning of the 24th, the president of Feathercombs heard a disturbance outside his office where a quick-witted girl had been positioned to filter out creditors and tax inspectors. A male voice spoke with urgency that scaled rapidly to anger. The intercom on the president's desk buzzed and buzzed again. He heard a chime of glass breaking. It sounded like a telephone when you slammed down the receiver. Before the president could rise from his chair to see what the matter was, my grandfather muscled into the room. He brandished a black handset, in those days a blunt instrument, that trailed 3 feet of frayed cord. Back in the late 1930s, when he wasn't hustling pool, my grandfather had put himself through 4 years at Drexel Tech by delivering pianos for Wanamaker's department store. His shoulders spanned the doorway. His kinky hair escaped from its daily paste down of grill cream, wobbled atop his head. His face was so flushed with blood that he looked sunburned. "I never saw anyone so angry," an eyewitness told the news. "You could almost smell smoke coming off him." For his part, the president of Feathercombs was astonished to discover that he had approved the firing of a maniac. "What's this about?" he said. It was a pointless question, and my grandfather disdained to answer it. He was opposed to stating the obvious. "Most of the questions people asked you," he felt, "were there to fill up dead space, curtail your movements, divert your energy and attention." Anyway, my grandfather and his emotions were never really on speaking terms. He took hold of the frayed end of the telephone cord. He wound it twice around his left hand. The president tried to stand up, but his legs got tangled in the knee hole of his desk. His chair shot out from under him and toppled over, casters rattling. He screamed. It was a fruity sound, halfway to a yodel. As my grandfather fell on top of him, the president twisted himself toward the window overlooking East 57th Street. He just had time to notice that passersby seemed to be crowding together on the sidewalk below. My grandfather looped the cord of the handset around the president's throat. He had maybe 2 minutes before the rocket of his anger burned up its fuel and fell back to earth. That would be ample time. During World War II, he had been trained in the use of a garrote, typically a length of piano wire concealed inside a shoe or bootlace. He knew that, done properly, strangulation was short work. "Oh, my God," said the secretary, Miss Mangle, making a late appearance on the scene. She had reacted quickly when my grandfather burst into her office, smelling, she would afterward recall, like wood smoke. She had managed to buzz twice before my grandfather grabbed the handset away from her. He picked up the intercom, he yanked the handset cord from the base. "You'll have to pay for that," Miss Mangle said. When he told this story 32 years later, my grandfather put a check mark of admiration beside Miss Mangle's name. But with his rocket only halfway up the slope of its parabola, he took her words as provocation. He threw the base of the intercom out the window of Miss Mangle's office. The chiming noted by the president was the sound of the intercom sailing through a spider web of glass into the street. Hearing a cry of outrage from below, Miss Mangle went to the window to look. Down on the sidewalk, a man in a gray suit was sitting, looking up at her. There was blood on the left lens of his round spectacles. He was laughing. There's a footnote to he was laughing. My grandfather knew only that the man he had accidentally beamed, fortunately the intercom had only grazed his skull, declined to press charges. The Daily News identifies his victim as Yuri Nosek, head of the Czechoslovakian delegation to the august body that Alger Hiss had helped to charter. This is the first time the high-ranking Red has been hit by a flying telephone, the news reported with a straight face, adding, Nosek said that as a good Czech, he was obliged to laugh off anything that didn't kill him. Police stopped to help him. The doorman announced that he was going to call the police. That was when Miss Mangle heard her boss screaming. She turned from the window to run into his office. At first glance, the office appeared to be empty. Then she heard the tap of a shoe against a linoleum floor, a tap, another tap. The back of my grandfather's head rose from behind the desk, then sank again. Brave Miss Mangle went around the desk. Her boss lay sprawled on his belly on the polished floor. My grandfather straddled his back, hunched forward, applying the impromptu garrote. The president bucked and thrashed and tried to roll himself over. The only sound was the toes of his Cordovan bucks trying to get purchase against the linoleum. Miss Mangle snatched up a letter opener from the president's desk and jabbed it into my grandfather's left shoulder. In my grandfather's reckoning, many years later, this action merited another check mark. The point of the letter opener sank only half an inch or so into meat, but the bite of metal blocked some meridian in the flow of my grandfather's rage. He grunted. It was like I woke up, he said, when he told me this part of the story for the first time during the last week of his life. He unwound the cord from the president's neck. He peeled it from the grooves it had cut into the flesh of his own left hand. The handset clattered against the floor. With a foot on either side of the president, he stood up and took a step away. The president flopped onto his back and raised himself into a sitting position, then sledded backward on his ass into a notch between two filing cabinets. He sobbed for air. When his face had hit the floor, he'd bitten his lower lip, and now his teeth were dyed pink. My grandfather turned to face Miss Mangle. He plucked out the letter opener and laid it on the president's desk. When one of his rages wore off, you could see regret flooding his eyes like seawater. He dropped his hands to his sides. Forgive me, he said to Miss Mangle and the president. I suppose he was also saying it to my mother, 14 at the time, and to my grandmother, though arguably she was as much to blame as my grandfather. There was scant hope of forgiveness, but my grandfather did not sound as if he expected or even wanted to find any. Thank you.
All right. So I'm just going to get my stuff in order here.
This is like our fourth time doing something together. Is that
fourth
right?
Fourth time, yeah. Just, you know, keep writing books and we'll keep chatting about them.
We could just like all live in a big house together.
We could. We could just show video of the previous
That's true.
But so many questions. Let's start with the way this opens. This is how I heard the story. It seems to me that that's a kind of a fundamental way that storytelling works, but it's not something that we often kind of encode into or see encoded into a book, not just, you know, once upon a time or something, mm-hmm. but the idea of the writer first as listener, as having heard the story and then kind of internalized the story and recapitulated the story. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the idea of writer as listener. The writer as listener is a big part of this novel, the role of the writer
right.
as listener.
So yeah, the narrator is in the position of just listening to his grandfather's stories throughout the length of the book. So I wanted to get that clear from the first, but I think even more important to me was to try to introduce this idea of this is how I heard the story, mm-hmm. Implying maybe other people heard the story in a different way than the way I heard it. And also, this is how I heard the story, meaning because of the way I am, I may be adding things to this story that were not there when it was told, but this is how I heard it. So,
right.
So there's a sort of, I just wanted to make it, try to begin signaling to the reader immediately that this is a version, and this is a kind of like an avowed version of events. It is not in any sense the facts in the case.
And you mean, I mean, I hate to do the air quote thing, but you mean I, right? Because the narrator
exactly.
of the book, who is a writer,
the whole
named
sentence,
Michael,
every word should just be
right. Every word, right. It's just an air quote kind of conversation. But this is a book that is narrated by a novelist named Michael Chabon, who is a fictional character in a certain way.
Well, oh no, no doubt. And in fact, it's actually almost we hear. The narrator never calls himself anything, and he's referred to every once in a while by his grandfather as Mike.
And his mother, periodically.
And his mother calls him Mike. And then you're presented with this thing right up front in the book, which is an ad for Chabon Scientific Company. Mm-hmm. It's a company that sold model rockets, and little models, miniature skeletons, human skeletons, a must for every closet. It says in the ads, and a few other products, and that's real. I mean, the ad is real. It's just a photocopy of an actual ad, and it's
and that
my
was
last
that
name.
Was the family business.
I don't know. I don't know anything about Chabon Scientific Company. And that's part of what appealed to me about it was just that it was. Like so few things in this age, it was ungoogleable. It was if you Googled it, at least at the time when I was researching, all you got were images of their ads in the backs of old magazines, or people. Like, there are dealers on eBay who cut up old magazines and sell the ads. I guess like if you're into Ford Mustangs, you might want to buy an ad for 1966 Ford Mustang. So. The person selling it was just selling it out of his stock of old magazines, and that's where I saw it on eBay. And I knew nothing about Chabon Scientific. I asked my dad; he'd never heard about it. If your last name is Chabon, you're related to me somehow, but we have no idea. So that part of what I wanted to do in this book was make up for this gap mm-hmm. By creating a history of Chabon Scientific Company. So because of that ad. And later on, you meet a few characters who have the last name Chabon. You can assume his name might be Michael
right,
Chabon.
Exactly.
But it's, I don't know, I could never quite go all the way to committing myself to saying this is Michael Chabon. Writing those two words next to each other wouldn't have quite felt.
Yeah, no, but I think that, you know, because it does cast in a question. I mean, one of the interesting things about the book is it's overlapping narratives. I mean, you've got Mike, the writer, who is sort of the narrator of the book. We just heard him introduce the book. But a large part of the book is derived from stories that the grandfather is telling, even
right.
when they're written in sort of in third person.
Right.
They are the grandfather's stories, right. and they're stories the grandfather has never told. It's a new side of the grandfather.
Right.
So I'm interested, too, in that question of the relationship of those narrators and those narratives, if we can talk about that.
Sure. Well, I mean, everything you get is filtered through the narrator. And I think you're aware of it all the time that it's the grandson, 25 years after his grandfather's death, who's telling you what he remembers from when his grandfather was telling him all of the stuff in the last days of his life, and what the grandfather's remembering. Some of it goes all the way back to like the earliest things in the book are in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. So there's this double gap. There's a double remove of time, and there's a double remove of point of view that both allowed me to have the freedom in terms of language and description and detail. Like, I mean, in the passage I just read, obviously, when the grandfather is telling his grandson about the time he went on a rampage in the offices of Feathercombs, he's probably not going to mention. Well, he certainly didn't say his teeth were dyed pink, right? He probably just. He might. Maybe he said I gave him a fat lip or something. So, and the grandfather was. It seems,
and he's not going to quote the New York Daily News on the check.
Right, exactly. No, he couldn't. Right? Yeah, I mean, that's exactly. I had this advantage of being able to actually go and do the research. Or I should say, like, pretend to go and do the research since I made the whole thing up. But you know, that there's a freedom you get from, like, if I had decided I'm going to tell this in the grandfather's words, I could have done it. It would have felt artificial, I think, in a way, and it would have hampered my ability to create a persuasive character in the grandfather. So by filtering everything through this grandson's recollection of what his grandfather told him, I could have the language I wanted to have, but I also got to really stay in the grandfather's point of view consistently, deeply, giving you the most intimate, secret thoughts of the grandfather in a way that even if he's on heavy doses of Dilaudid as he is in this thing, he still would. There are bound to be things he would never have revealed, even under these influence of these drugs to his grandson, and I'm sort of pretending that he did, or else it's just the grandson kind of filling in the gaps with his own imagination.
Right. Now, I mean, the basis, and I want to talk about the sort of, I don't know what we want to call it, I hesitate to call it a fake memoir in some way, but the kind of... the lie component. We should probably read the author's note, which says, in preparing this memoir... This is right over the ad for the Shame on Scientific. In preparing this memoir, I have stuck to facts, except when facts refuse to conform with memory, narrative purpose, or the truth as I prefer to understand it. Wherever liberties have been taken with names, dates, places, events, and conversations, or with the identities, motivations, and interrelationships of family members and historical personages, the reader is assured that they have been taken with due abandon.
So basically saying I made this whole thing up.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, a lot of the things in this book are real.
Right.
And there are things in this book that happened to members of my family, if not my grandfather, another male relative.
The Hiss story,
to
for
me,
instance.
The Alger Hiss story.
I mean, not the attempted murder.
This is the interesting thing. Like, even with that, like I heard the story. This is how I heard the story. I heard a story that one of my grandfather's brothers was fired from his job as a salesman in a company, actually not Feathercombs, but where Alger Hiss worked after he lost his job at Feathercombs. He worked for an office, like a paper, forms. They sold invoices and things to businesses, like pads of invoices with carbons and so on. And he was fired from that job to make room for Alger Hiss. Like, I heard this story, I guess, from my grandfather. And when I started thinking, when I realized what I was working on, I reached out to that man's granddaughter, my cousin, and her mother, also my cousin, my second and first cousin, and one of them had never heard this at all, and the other said, you know, I remember him, he worked for a different company, and what I remember is just that he was shocked that one day he went wherever he saw, all the paper pad salesmen hung out somewhere together at some bar, like Barry Levinson characters. One day Alger Hiss is at the table hanging out with all these carbon men or whatever they call themselves. And just, that's what she remembered. Like, just that, like, he comes home from work one day, he's like, can you believe who's working in this business now? So even that, like, I thought I was working with a kind of authentic family thing that I remember being told, and even that turned out to be sort of dubious, or there are different versions of it, and at least the way that my cousin remembers it is different from the way I remember having heard it. So, you know, that idea of whose version of the story becomes the story, and how truth is arrived at in families, and sometimes there is a kind of consensus version that emerges or is imposed on everyone, and other times there's never any agreement, you know, and you sit with your siblings and you start remembering something, and you know, my brother will say, like, Dad wasn't there. I'm like, yeah, he was. I remember. He's like, no, he was totally not there. You're totally wrong. And we both feel right. And so it's that that interplay of memory and kind of wishfulness and how you kind of hope things would turn out in your family, or if your narrative is, if a narrative in your family is more a negative narrative, then details kind of get altered to just increase the negative version of whatever it is you're trying to tell. And then through the retelling, things get emphasized and other things fall away. So that, memory is a fiction, in my view. Mm-hmm. Anything but the, and like, unless you are actually, you use some assistant, you take notes, you take careful notes and you jot things down. Anytime you're relying on your memory and you're making a report, you're falsifying. Not intentionally, necessarily.
Right. But even those notes, right? Because those notes are all about select. You can't. It's not possible to transcribe every instant.
And you're, who knows what you're missing while you're busy jotting down the notes. So, you know. I'm definitely not trying to hoodwink anybody with this book. She was very labeled very carefully.
It says a novel right on the cover. Yeah.
Everyone is warned, and then there's that author's note, and then if you should happen to read all the way to the end, you get to the acknowledgments, and where in the acknowledgments, it's also, I reiterate the fact that everything you just read, even so, it's been fascinating to me to see the things people assume must be true.
You thank your fictional characters, don't you?
Yes, I acknowledge.
I can't find it. I thank them for letting me. I thank them for letting me talk to them if they had existed.
Of people and their job titles and where they work, various research librarians and so on. And they say, and they would have been very helpful if they existed.
Right.
So part of what interested me, part of what drove me to want to write this, I think, I wasn't conscious, but was this experience, having had this experience so many times of people assuming the people, like with Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, I had people after that book came out who said, you know, I would love to get a hold of some of Joe Cavalier's artwork. Like, where can I, you know, who deals in it? Or after the Yiddish Policeman's Union came out, a woman came to me at a reading, I think in Philadelphia, and said, you know, my husband and I took that Inside Passage cruise in Alaska last year, and we stopped in Sitka, and I don't know how I missed all those tall buildings there. I must have been looking in the wrong direction. And so, you know, that happening, and then the kind of experience where I'm talking about, where one person in the same who was there remembers something totally differently. And then finally, this strange thing that has happened a few times in my life since I started publishing. It happened once with my brother. I wrote a series of short stories about the Shapiro family. They're in my first collection, and they're heavily autobiographical. I freely acknowledge that. And they're about a family just like my family, mom, dad, two brothers, and the family, the parents get divorced, and five short stories that sort of track from just before the parents separate to after, in the aftermath of the divorce. And while those stories are autobiographical, and I drew very freely on things I remembered and things that really happened and so on, my version of them, also I made a whole lot up in those stories too. I had to, because real life is boring, and fiction, thank God, is not. So one day I'm driving, my brother and I, we went to Las Vegas. I was living down here in Southern California, and he was too, and we went for a weekend in Las Vegas. We talked the whole way in the car, and coming home, we talked the whole way back, and we were reminiscing, and he starts to tell me this story about when we took this vacation in North Carolina as kids, and you know, I don't even remember what it was, but Dad said that, and Mom did that, and I almost had to stop the car. I said, Steve, I made that up. Like, that's just, that never happened. That was just in the short story I wrote. Like, and he's like, what? No, I remember that. I'm like, no, you don't, you can't. So it didn't happen. I made it up. And, you know, it's that is, and what, so what, in a way, I did that to myself because, do you have any questions here?
Or? Not yet. I'm good. I do have some.
Okay. Because You know, people have asked me, like, why you're there, the grandfather's always called my grandfather, the grandmother's always called my grandmother. You know, why not name them? Why don't you say their names? And in part, and I talked about how it's the narrator's never referred to directly as Michael Chabon, and it's in part because I'm writing a memoir. I wanted this to read as much like a real memoir as I possibly could. And when people write about their parents in memoirs, they call them dad or my dad or my father. I was working on a Frank Sinatra movie for a while, and I read this both Sinatra daughters' memoirs. And in both of them, they refer to their father as daddy. Daddy did this. Daddy came into the room. So that felt natural to say my grandfather. But at some point, you know, I thought, well, these people do have names, presumably. Like, there are some contexts where their names might kind of organically come into something. Someone like, you know, I'm sorry to say Mr. So-and-so, but your wife is whatever. Like, it would be natural to have the person's last name be mentioned in this line of dialogue. And I might actually have to go to a certain amount of contortion to avoid having that happen. Right. So maybe I should just give them names. And I couldn't do it. And the reason I couldn't do it is because I couldn't say my real grandfather's name was Ernest Cohen, my maternal grandfather, and his wife was Nettie. I couldn't call these people Ernest Cohen and Nettie. That, first of all, I don't know the amount of energy that would be generated by the spinning in the grave that would occur.
Right.
It could power an entire East Coast city, but it just was wrong. Like, that's not who these people are. Like, they're not, it's not Nettie Cohen. It would be ridiculous to call this character Nettie Cohen. But when I tried to call them anything, you know, Morris Schlabowski and his wife, whatever, that felt wrong too. And the reason it felt wrong was because these are my grandparents.
Right.
These are my grandparents. Like, they became my grandparents in some way. Just like my brother came to believe that this thing that I made up about a fictional family had really happened. These were too much my grandparents for me to call them by some last name that wasn't wasn't in my family.
No, that makes complete sense. I mean, I once wrote an essay about something my brother and I did together, and when it came out, he said, "Oh, that's exactly how I remember it." And I thought, then I got it wrong. You know, over the years, we must have had the reverse experience, or we must have discussed it over the years enough that we kind of created a consensus narrative, and that became the narrative that was published. But this raises a really interesting question to me, and I think it's one of the things that operates in the book, the question of reliability, the reliable narrator. Mm-hmm. I've long believed there's no such thing as reliable. All narrators are unreliable. And what we're looking at here is a sequence of unreliable narrators, in a sense, right? From the writer who is telling us this story as a memoir that may or, you know, that is incorporating elements of reality in the service of fiction, to the grandfather's story, which is being told in the last week or 10 days of his life under the influence of heavy-duty drugs, and he's revealing whole sides of himself that have not been who he was, to, without giving anything away for the people who haven't read the book, to other stories, the grandmother story, for instance, which is a series of kind of almost like Russian nesting dolls in a certain way. So every narrative is both reliable and unreliable, and then they're all kind of filtered through each other in a certain sense.
Right. I mean, and that's what happens in families, right? I mean, that's how it works. And I had the experience so many times as a kid of sort of after my parents separated and then divorced. I got to an age where I started to ask questions about, like, how did you meet and why did you get married and all those kind of things. The answers I got from each parent were so totally different from each other. I was shocked, you know. And I went to my mom at some point and I told her something my dad had said, and this was hilarious because I don't want to get too much into it, but she actually had document. She went and into the closet and she got down this box, and it had to do with why they had gotten married, the answer to that question. And my father implied that my mother got pregnant and that's why they got married. And I took that was like my eyes were so opened by that. I was like, oh, well, that kind of explains why you never got along and you got divorced, right? Because also it was the 1970s, so there was a law that said you had to get divorced. But we got rid of that eventually. That click, I thought, okay, I can buy that. And then I went home for Christmas break or something. I told my mom, yeah, Dad told me about this thing. And she's like, that's not true. We were engaged. And then I got pregnant. And then we got married. And I said, oh, that's kind of more disappointing version right. of the story. And then she went and got this box down and like starts rooting around. She comes up with the announcement from the Washington Post of the engagement of my parents.
Oh, and so she could date it.
She dated it. Yeah. Was like, and it was a matter of months, obviously, right. trying to figure out, like, is this 7 months or 9 months? And I mean, what do you do with when that happens? And like, this is how they remember. Like, mm-hmm. my dad obviously was remembering incorrectly, but
it becomes his truth.
It was his truth, right. exactly. And in a way, like I said, it seemed to explain more than my mom's version. Although, then I'll say, and this is something I try to play with in the book too, is like the power of photographs and the mystery of photographs, because of old family photographs. Because at some point thereafter, I opened up a book that had been my dad's that he had given to me, and it had a black and white photo that someone had taken on like a summer afternoon. At the time, this would have been before they even had gotten engaged, and it was basically my parents making out. Like, they were as a picnic, there was a blanket, and my mom was kind of lying on her back, and she had this halter top on, and my dad was kind of on top of her, and then maybe they're hamming it up a little for the camera, but like they're kissing. And like I looked at the picture, and I'm like, oh, okay, now my mom's version kind of makes more sense in a way, because they were in love or something.
Right, and it actually makes your mom's version there. A sexier story.
Yes.
Right.
So then I had sort of like a whole third version of the story, but one that I had to supply all the details for, in a way.
I want to ask there are many interesting things about the book and about the characters. The grandfather is someone who, as you in that reading said, he wasn't on speaking terms with his emotions. Mm-hmm. He's silent. He's taciturn. Mm-hmm. You know, he goes through transformative, traumatic experiences. People ask him what it's like, and he says it was interesting. Uh-huh. And that's it. So I want to ask you about the challenge.
How should it be?
Exactly. Right? Yeah. What is the challenge of writing about a character who is? I mean, granted, the setup of the last days of his life, he is no longer taciturn, but he's mm-hmm. marked by taciturnity. That's his defining
right.
character detail. So to sort of build a narrative in part, I mean, the grandmother is also a major character. There are other characters throughout, but he really is the sort of narrative driver. To build a narrative around a character who's so taciturn, mm-hmm. who's so kind of emotionally closed in some mm-hmm. sense, I'm curious about those challenges.
Well, it did prove a challenge in certain circumstances, although it's always a reliable source of comedy, if nothing else,
yeah.
by his like way his responses can be incommensurate with circumstances. But I think more than that, when someone is not talking, they're noticing more, mm-hmm. and that's convenient for a writer, because I'm a narrative is basically a string of perceptions in a sense, and so if you have someone who's not talking very much, and also in this case, this character is my grandfather in this book was my actual grandfather, an engineer, trained engineer. He's paid it. He's been trained to notice things, and in fact, his job when he's in the army is to pick up little clues and follow them, and so on. So
and he's very. I mean, he may not speak a lot, but he's extremely active.
Yes. So, and that was another advantage too. It was easy to get him to do things because he wasn't so busy talking. But I'll also say. And this might not be very persuasive because I haven't basically shut up since I sat down in this chair tonight, but in a way, it's sort of a projection or a wish fulfillment for myself, because believe it or not, secretly, like my true inner being is a very taciturn person. I would prefer not to speak
right.
if I thought I could get away with it.
And how's that working for you?
Well, nobody will let me. But, you know, and to me, the sort of surprising discovery of this book was that, you know, I knew it was it's a novel, it's a fake memoir, it's a false autobiography and as told to kind of story. And so the characters are invented as much as they are based in bits and pieces on real things. But what I didn't expect or didn't anticipate was how much the character of the grandfather was going to come out as a kind of strange self-portrait. And that, so it is, in a weird way, it's an autobiography. My autobiography, but in an imaginary sense, in that it's a what-if kind of thing, because I, unlike the character of the grandfather, it's for whatever reason, I sort of set forth on this course as a small child of being a good boy, mm-hmm. and of wanting to please my parents and then please my teachers and do the right thing and be personable and sociable. And even though none of that stuff came naturally to me, I felt like I had to. So I had to learn how to do it. And I forced myself through life until, you know, at some point it became somewhat habitual, or I didn't have to constantly think about it, but it never felt right. And there's a part of me, in all sincerity, that just wants to never say anything and not talk to people and not have any friends and or very few friends and just live alone in a cave somewhere. And I don't necessarily value that part of myself, but it's really there. And in creating the character of this, he never tried to be a good boy. He was a bad boy when he was little, and he disobeyed his parents. And he didn't do what he was supposed to do. He's like the oldest son in a Jewish immigrant family. His younger brother is the one who kind of stepped up and fulfilled all their wishes.
Was
and
the success, right? He was a cool hustler.
He became a rabbi.
Yeah.
And he was a little miniature. He was a tzaddik at the age of 8. And the little brother is the one who stepped in. And as a result, the grandfather had this freedom to be bad. And he did whatever he wanted to. And he got into trouble and he got into fights and he became a pool hustler, and he consorted with gangsters, although took most of that material out of the book. But I couldn't help thinking at some point, like, maybe if I had just had the courage to be a bad boy, then I could have, like, gone through life not ever having to talk to anybody, which is my dream.
This is really interesting, because one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was... in large parts of the book, I mean, the grandfather. You're a writer now, and the character when he's hearing these stories is in his 20s.
Mm-hmm.
The grandfather dies in 1990, right? Mm-hmm. So the character's in his late 20s. But the writer who's writing this book is someone who's 25 years older than
mm-hmm.
that, which puts him into the same kind of chronology as the grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's most compelling to me about the book is the portrait of the marriage, mm-hmm. The relationship between the grandparents, which as a reader who has been married for a long time and is deeply cognizant of, you know, the complexity of that mm-hmm. of those long-term relationships, I was curious about sort of the insight that your own experience mm-hmm. in that regard brings to the portrait of that relationship.
That is the other way in which this book kind of became a surprise autobiography. I'm glad you asked that, because I forgot to mention it. Is that, I mean, my wife, Ayelet Waldman, has been, I only feel kind of free since, because she's been very open in writing about her her struggles with what ultimately got diagnosed as PMDD, but some kind of mood disorder, and you know, the experience of being married to someone who's struggling with that kind of illness completely fed into my portrait of this marriage between these two people who are absolutely and completely in love and enmeshed with each other from the moment they meet, and through all of the storm and struggle that they go through in the course of this story, and it gets very bad sometimes for the grandparents in this book. That is never... The bond itself remains unscathed from start to finish, although it's tested severely at many points.
Even late in the book, you have I don't think I'm giving anything away, but there's the scene where the grandfather comes home from work. The little boy of the narrator is there, and the way their bodies come together, the grandparents' bodies come together while they're standing at the table watching their grandson eat,
mm-hmm.
is so charged.
Yeah, they never lose that their involvement with each other.
Right.
And I think that is often the case with in long-lived, successful marriages, even ones that are completely racked by whatever kind of strife and trouble and bad luck or bad health or whatever it might be. But again, that was, in a way, I was like halfway into constructing this whole story and relationship and the way the grandmother is in the book and all of the things about the grandfather's sort of soldiering on before it ever actually occurred to me, oh, hey, wait, this is kind of a little bit like Ayala and me in some ways. I wonder what she's going to think about this when I give her the book. And I was a little nervous in a way that I almost have never been before. Mm-hmm. With this book, you know, we read each other's work regularly in the course of its composition. So right at the end of the first draft, when I had a first draft of this, when I gave it to her, I was a little apprehensive. I just, in spite of the fact that she herself has been so open about it, and she noticed it right away, and she commented on it, but she said, you know, this is, just keep going. I like what you're doing here. It's okay. Don't worry about it. So then I carried on. But that was an unintentional, it was just I'd never expected I was going to, it never occurred to me for a second I would be revealing anything about myself with all of these layers of the onion.
But, through the fictional memoir. Mm-hmm, exactly. So this is interesting in the sense of what the process of discovery that you undergo in terms of this book, in terms of other books. Mm-hmm. How much do you know going in? I mean, obviously you did a lot of, you know, fake research mm-hmm. for this book.
Although there's a lot of fake research,
mm-hmm. hours and hours of Star Trek on the internet.
Exactly.
And but how much do you generally, I mean, when you start, how much do you generally know? How in the case of this book, whether in terms of some of the historical stuff going back to Philadelphia mm-hmm. in the 1940s, mm-hmm. Or also in terms of the emotional dynamics.
I mean, this book took a lot of actual research, not just inventing stories in the daily news, but actually trying to get, you know, I mean, the thing about lying is to do it really well, you have to use persuasive details. And if the lie you're telling is set in Baltimore in 1952, I've been to Baltimore, but I was born in 1963. I have no idea what Baltimore was like in 1952. I have to inform myself somehow. Mm-hmm. Turn to the internet, turn to books, histories of Baltimore, histories of Jewish Baltimore. I mean, Barry Levinson's movies were there for me. Mm-hmm. But Baltimore's one of those cities, it was almost an accidental choice, but it was a good choice because it's one of those cities that people who grew up there have gone on to document it in various ways, in writing and in film and so on. So there was a lot there for me, but I did have to, that's not so much because I'm trying to trick the reader into thinking this is all real somehow. That's because I'm trying to have characters who feel real to the reader, and for the characters to feel real, they have to feel like they're the product of the place they're living
in. And the world has to feel real.
Exactly.
Yeah. But there is a point at which, I mean, you know, T.C. Boyle once said, you know, I research for a little bit, but if I research too much, then it blocks the imaginative flow.
Well, yeah, no, it's constraining, and it's, you have to remind yourself at some point that you're not writing nonfiction. You're writing fiction. You can take liberties, and it's knowing when to take liberties and how much research is enough research. And it can, with the internet, it can be so seductive to just endlessly keep researching. And
well, it's easier than writing.
Yeah, much easier than writing. And you do find stuff out. You find out, you know, we were talking about a little before, it's like a slot machine with the intermittent reward thing, where you occasionally you hit the jackpot and you find something that's so crucial, so enormous, so critical. You can't imagine that you were ever contemplating writing the book without knowing this thing that you just found.
Right.
But that just gives you more rationale to keep wasting time on the internet. I mean, the example that I've given before is with Cavalier and Clay, when I was I was so desperate to try to find a theater of World War II to send Joe Cavalier to that that would not be a theater of war that anybody had, that felt so heavily trafficked as all the other Europe and Japan and and North Africa and so on. So Italy, all these big novels that came out of the war, or actual veterans wrote novels that were set in those various places. And then I read this thing on the internet about the U.S. Navy sending an expedition to Antarctica in 1941. And I was like, yes, you know, that's it. It's the Antarctic Theater, and I'm going to send them, you know. And then I keep reading along, and it's like, and they went back in September 1941, and the U.S. never sent any further military personnel there until after the war. So,
right.
And like my first thought was like, oh, damn it. That was going to be so good. I could have had a whole Antarctic thing. And then I had to remind myself, like, wait a minute, this is a novel. If I want there to be a U.S. naval base in Antarctica during World War II, all I have to do is say there was a U.S. naval base in Antarctica during World War II, but then I have to do the research. Like,
exactly.
I have
right?
to, like,
you can move Tel Aviv to Alaska, basically,
yes.
if you want to, but
yes.
It has to be a believable landscape.
It takes a very big truck, too. It
takes a very big, probably more than one truck.
Yeah, maybe.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I'm curious. I want to go back to these complexities and the complexities. I'm wondering, as you have, I mean, you've always written kind of fully fleshed, complicated characters, but as you've grown as a writer, as you've matured, as you've gotten older, you know, the complexity.
Thanks for reminding me.
Yeah, I know. It's the curse of all of us. But what, you know, I'm curious about the way that complexity of life experience begins to reflect the complexity of characters. Do you feel that you're writing more complicated relationships, more complicated character dynamics now, or even say in Telegraph Avenue, which was a kind of multi-generational saga mm-hmm. in its way, than say in books like Wonder Boys or something?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think the big change for me was, or the big blow was having children,
mm-hmm.
and then in a way you changed teams when you have children, and suddenly
you're not the kid anymore.
You're reading Romeo and Juliet when you read it in, you know, in high school or college, and you're like, those stupid Capulets and Montagues, if they just would have left Romeo and Juliet alone, they, you know. And then, you know, then you have kids and you're like, why didn't you listen to your parents? They
right.
said not to marry him,
and they right? knew what they were talking about.
You changed teams,
right.
So There aren't that many fathers in my fiction before I became a father, but when there are fathers that you see the fathers from a child's point of view,
right.
even if it's an adult child. And I see a few little flashes of what I thought it, or there's a little bits in here where I sort of project into the father's point of view, and I feel like it's totally off. I was still pretty young when I tried to do it. Partly that experience, I mean, you're called upon so continually as a parent to put yourself in your kid's shoes so consistently and try to, you know, you have that first reaction of like, well, this is obviously a bad idea or whatever. And then you learn to stop and think, okay, what is going on here? Why is this actually, what is she really asking for? Or how does it seem to her in this situation? How can I actually try to imagine my way through whatever it was that brought us to this apparent conflict that we're having right now, like just that constant exercise of that faculty of trying to put yourself in someone else's shoes and in a marriage as well.
Or how do you...
I think it helps create fictional characters.
Or how do you let them make a mistake, even if you think they're going to make a mistake?
Yes. Like
How do you let them learn the lesson?
Yeah, I don't know if that's ever helped me write a better book,
really
though.
But,
either,
but I was hoping you were going to give me
definitely the hard thing to do.
I was hoping you were going to give me some piece of wisdom.
No.
But no, I mean, I think that's...
Well, they're so dumb.
Yeah.
How can they be trusted with... No, I mean, it is... You have to... that is part of it in a way. It's that you just have to try to stop and, like, remember and think, like, oh, wait, okay, this sounds like the most asinine thing I've ever heard, but I probably had a similarly asinine idea myself
right.
when I was 15 years old and, you know, holding 3 large staple guns or whatever is going on right now. And,
and
you know,
standing on a ladder.
Let me just try to exercise that imaginative faculty. And I do feel like maybe that has increased my willingness to try to imagine things outside a more comfortable, narrow zone of my own personal direct experience that did show up some in Telegraph Avenue. I tried writing from the point of view of African-American mm-hmm. characters, including a woman African-American character who is giving birth, which is something I've yet to experience. You know, to just feel like maybe I could do that is something I don't think I would have even dared to imagine when I was first starting out. But also, I was sort of callow and narcissistic, and why would I want to?
Right.
Know, like, it's so cool being young.
Right.
Why would I want to be some old person having a baby coming out of their body?
Exactly. No, I have long thought that that's where, you know, when you have a child is when you realize I'm not cool.
No, for sure.
I never was cool. I was able to maintain this illusion, but now I know I'm not.
I realized that before I even became a child, because I remember seeing, watching on MTV sometime in the early 90s, and I saw Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers talking about his teenage daughter at the time and how he had introduced her to, I don't remember, let's say it was Lenny Kravitz or someone like that, and she was so excited, and now she thinks I'm cool.
Right.
And I was like, wait, Flea's daughter doesn't think he's cool?
Right. Like, she's also walking 15 feet ahead.
Exactly. Like, then it's just hopeless. Yeah.
So I want to ask one more question, and then I want to turn it over, and I want to go back to sort of the complexities of character. The first time, and I don't believe in the whole likable character thing, and mm-hmm. I also think these characters are quite likable, but it's another challenge to introduce. We first meet the grandfather in the midst of a homicidal rage.
Mm-hmm.
and then we sort of witness the fallout of that homicidal rage. Mm-hmm. And then as the book progresses, of course, we get to see, you know, 350 other sides of the grandfather mm-hmm. and his complexity develop. So just in a kind of narrative sense, I'm curious about, I mean, it's a great scene to start with. It's mm-hmm. It's a total attention grabber. But in terms of establishing the character, it both is and isn't representative in a certain mm-hmm. sense. So I'm curious about the, you know, your sense of that, or perhaps even the risks of beginning in that sense as far as how readers might respond or react to the character. Or is that even something that was on your mind when you were writing?
Well, I mean, it's just the organic starting place of the book itself that I started with this, what I had thought was an accurate memory of this thing I'd heard about my great uncle getting fired. That was the seed that I started with, and the first day I started working on this book, I started writing that episode. Right. And so maybe to some degree, things tend to settle into a shape, and sometimes, I mean, there are many times when I've gone back and what I thought was going to be the beginning of Cavalier and Clay, what's now the beginning was not the beginning. For a long time, it was something else. It was just when Joe Cavalier gets into bed with Sam Clay, that was the start of the book for almost its whole life. I think I added the actual beginning about 3 days before I turned it in mm-hmm. to my editor. So I have made changes up front. With this one, I feel like the issues of control and losing control are so central to his struggle throughout his life that it just felt like, in that sense, it's the right place to begin. It's also, this is the moment where we don't really know it yet, but this is the moment where this family almost breaks completely. Not the attack and what caused the grandfather to get so angry. It's not just that he got fired, it turns out. There was more going on.
And there's an enormous amount of fallout that runs throughout the whole book.
Right. It's just a central point. And even though the family does recover in a way, they never really quite recover, and a lot of other things get broken as a result of that. So it is sort of the central moment in the whole history of the family. Everything does sort of lead up to it and then follow from it. So it felt like it was the right place to start. And plus, I just wanted to, I think, you know, there's nothing sexier to start a novel with than a mention of Alger Hiss. That's one of the things they teach you in writing workshops.
It's true.
It's like Cold War communist references are like sure thing.
Yeah. No, so I agree.
That was what finally determined
me. I think
me.
That was genius.
Yeah, thank you. Genius. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate
my
the
pleasure.
Conversation.
You bet. Absolutely. Thank you.
So, If you raise your hands, we have microphones that will cycle through the crowd. And
first question.
All right.
If life is Rashomon, if there is no truth but only perception and recollection, where does that take you?
to my family dinner table every night. I mean, that's it. That's the stuff that we have to deal with. I mean, I think it's what I love about fiction is that it's open in its deception, and I think it's, if not unique, it's close to unique in that way, in that it is, it's a lie that admits that it's a lie right up front, and not only does it admit it's a lie right up front, but it, the reader is asking to be lied to, so it's lying with consent of the person being lied to, and that is what makes it okay, and that is what makes it pleasurable and enjoyable. And I mean, the other really obvious ready analogy for that is stage magic as a performing magician. It's the same thing. You know, the magician comes on and says, I'm going to make, like I saw Ricky Jay one time make real oranges grow on a mechanical orange tree. And like, obviously there's no such thing as a mechanical orange tree that can produce real oranges. You know that. He knows that. We all know that. You know there's a trick here somewhere, and that's why you're sitting there, because you want to be tricked. You want to be lied to. You're asking to be lied to. You're just insisting that it be done really well and really persuasively. And so that's rare. Almost all other kinds of deception and the distortions of memory, two people's version, eyewitness testimonies, like what the single most unreliable thing that can happen in a courtroom is eyewitness testimony. Almost every other form of that involves some kind of storytelling of recollection is either being done for self-aggrandizement, self-exoneration, accusing someone else of doing something. There's always some kind of agenda at work, even if it's unconscious, even if it's with all good intent. There's still the distortions that get introduced for some kind of purpose that the person being spoken to may or is not aware of. And with fiction, that's not true. I will hasten to add that with memoir, I don't think that's a memoir. It's a lot less obvious. I think it's a lot less overt, and that's what makes me a little bit uncomfortable as a reader of memoir always. And that was, I think, part of what I wanted to play with in presenting my novel as a memoir, was this, part of what I'm doing is saying to the reader, I want you to see just how easy it is for me to make a memoir. And I'm going to tell you right up front, it's a lie, but just forget that while you're reading it and see if you think this sounds different than a memoir might sound. The people are named Shaban. They're Shaban Scientific Company. I have the ad. Wernher von Braun is in there. And who else do I have in there? Other real-life people make passing appearances in the book. It sounds true. And I would make references to having written a novel set in Pittsburgh, or, oh, I know, like Mitch Kaplan, who owns Books and Books, bookstore in Coral Gables, Florida, is mentioned in the book, and when the narrator is giving a reading. And so it can all be done so easily to persuade you that this is a memoir. And in a way, I think I'm trying to just almost the way certain magicians will produce like spirit effects as part of their act, right? To sort of show you how spirit mediums operate. I think there's a slightly Houdini-esque element in my wanting to write a memoir for that same thing. You know, Houdini went around debunking spirit mediums by producing the same effects and then showing you how he had done it. So, I don't know if that answered your question, but that's okay because I can't remember what your question was. So,
okay, I think this might be a yes or no question. Pretty simple.
Yes.
I've been wondering this for a really long time, whether Professor Grady's character is named in homage to the character from All the Pretty Horses, by any chance?
Grady Tripp?
Yeah. John Grady.
Yeah,
I don't know.
No, he wasn't. I'm trying to think when did All the Pretty Horses come out? Do you remember? It was like 92?
Yeah. Yeah, 91 or 92.
That's when I started writing Wonder Boys, around then. So maybe unconsciously, but actually consciously, it was the guy that was on Sanford and Son, Grady Tate. Is that his name? I always loved him. Good googly moogly, he used to say. So, I mean, that was for me, I came up with the name Tripp first. It seemed like the right name for him because he was on a journey. And he was a little bit addled, too. So it just felt like the right name. And then once I had Tripp, I think I just tried out a few first names and thought of Grady from Sanford and Son. Just went with that.
Now I know.
Now you know.
The secrets have all been revealed.
Thank you. I loved the story you told of driving with your brother to Las Vegas and discovering a different memory of, or his having incorporated the memory. I'd like to ask, how sure can you be that it wasn't that you didn't?
You're right. And in fact, I think I had that momentary lapse of like, wait, didn't I make this up? No, you can't ever be sure. And my memory is, I rely on my memory so heavily. I trust my memory so completely. It never occurs to me for a moment, maybe I'm remembering this wrong. Like having that thought, maybe I'm remembering this wrong, is a very rare occurrence for me, in spite of the fact that I am given constant, almost daily evidence that my memory is totally unreliable. And of course I'm remembering it wrong because this continual proof, like take out an old Visa bill or something, and you're like looking through and you're like, what? Like, this reminds me, like we took this trip and we went to Palm Desert and I would have said I had never been to, I just said 3 days ago I've never been to Palm Desert, and then like I'm looking here and clearly, and like then it all comes, oh my God, that's right, and we did go there. Like that kind of thing happens to me all the time, and yet why doesn't that ever do anything to impeach the credibility of my own memory with myself? Whereas I'm perfectly willing to believe there's something wrong with your memory. It's like we, your memory is the sound of your own voice. Maybe bad things would happen if you started questioning your memory too, as much as it deserves to be questioned. Maybe we wouldn't be able to function anymore.
So you never fact check your, when I'm messing around on the internet, I often fact check my own memory.
Like in what context?
Like if I remember something, let's say if I remember I was at a public event or something, I'll look it up and I'll see if, you know, what's the box score of that baseball game? Do I remember the game correctly? What's the, you know, what was the set? You can find anything.
No,
like,
what
was the set
that.
List of that show?
No, you know? No. Yes, definitely. But not because I think I have it wrong. Although, but then in checking, I'll be like, oh my God, I totally have it wrong. But I didn't go in with the doubt. I go in like, I've got this, right? It was this and that and the other thing. And then I'll look and say, oh, actually, I was totally mistaken about that. No. And I mean, I think there's a certain amount, maybe I'm wrong about this. I feel like there's a certain, at least cultural aspect about being a man where it's very difficult to admit when you're wrong and you've made a mistake, and the world, at least until recently, the world still continues to be set up this way to make it, I think, kind of easy to act as if you didn't make a mistake when you're a man. It's both incumbent on you and also not that hard to do. And challenging, questioning myself, my perceptions, my memories, the things I think I know, it takes a constant effort. And I feel like I'm always reminding myself to do that because it's so easy not to. And like the world is set up to just allow you to pretend that you didn't say what you did say. And you can even become president of the United States by doing that.
Well, yes. And of course we are, you know, we are in California, the home of voter fraud.
Right.
Do we have any other questions? I think one more question, so.
I was thinking of this just as you said it. Undoubtedly, and I don't want to bum anybody out here, but when the Donald leaves the White House, he is undoubtedly going to write a memoir. Why don't you beat him to it? A fictional memoir before it happens.
That's kind of a cool idea. But I don't think I have the stomach for it.
Well, thank you, Michael.
Michael, thank you all. Thank you. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.